Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to learn how to live a longer life with a simple, inexpensive nutrient. Then we're going to also look at, in depth, the unprecedented in its potential impact. Could an anti-cancer study reignite the kava market? You've heard of kava, K-A-V-A. We'll deal with that. Also, I want to share some insights today about complementary medicine used widely to treat children with autism and developmental delay. This is in the University of California. They're finally realizing that a lot of educated parents are not relying upon a standard pharmaceutical approach, and there's good reason why they shouldn't. But what is standard medical care today? There is an article by Ralph Nader that's really brilliant, and it really sums it up, and it gives us a lot of new statistics. And I'm going to share this with you. It's called What We Don't Know in the Information Age, and then also about the cost of medicine. For example, why do you go into a hospital, and with nothing at all, they'll charge you $2,000? For what? What are you getting? Why? Medical price gouging, profiteering in greed and waste are skyrocketing. Ralph Nader, Huffington Post. And by the way, I'll give you specific hospitals, and there a lot of them are around where this audience is, but I'll also tell you how much of a percentage that they charge you above their costs. Let me give you an example. Let's say that that a pound of apples, organic apples, cost the store, the health food store, a dollar. They'll sell it for $1.50. Very small markup. All right, 50% max. And then sometimes they discount it from there. What if I told you that there's a hospital, Meadowlands Hospital, Medical Center in Secaucus, New Jersey, above their cost, 1,192% margin of profit? Whoa. Who gets that kind of money? They do. Ah. So it's all about the money. It's always been about the money. So we're going to go into that in our public health segment today. Also, I just wanted to see what the alternative and mainstream media had to say about Errol Sharon. So I read the obituaries and read the different reviews of his work and life. I didn't find any of them, to be honest, or accurate. So I'll share one and let you know why he was called the bulldozer of Israel, his real legacy. If time permits, we're also going to look at student debt and 20 years of NAFTA poverty and lies. Most of the lawmakers will move in a heartbeat to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They shouldn't. There's nothing in there that benefits the American people, or for that matter, most people in the world. But it does benefit the 600 major corporations whose lobbyists are working on it. Oh, and no one in the United States, no citizen, no journalist, no member of Congress, is allowed to know what's in it. But the president wants to have the right to fast-track it. So what did Nancy Pelosi say? You'll know what's in the bill once we pass it. I see. So we should trust you, Congress. And then we find out what's in it. Well, I'm going to play a little clip today of something that's in it that you didn't know about. And it's very specific, because we went through and we verified it. On a certain page, a certain paragraph, a certain sentence. And how did it get by everyone? They can implant, at the discretion of the Secretary of Health, chips in our bodies. Did you know that? It's true. It's there. The kind of thing you wouldn't imagine that everyone would have let slip by. That's a problem when you have thousands of pages that nobody read. And this way, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's even worse. I'll go into that. My guest in the second part of our program is Dr. Marty Wolfson. We're going to talk about this America's $17 trillion gross debt. And why are they going after Social Security? Social Security is not an entitlement. The government doesn't give me money. The government's not paying into that fund. We do. Employees and employers pay into Social Security. And then later in life, we get it back in increments. So how is that an entitlement? We shouldn't be touching Social Security at all. But they're trying, and this president's already said, yeah, he's going after it, as if it's an entitlement. So what I did is I decided to show you real entitlements. So what I've done is this. I've made a list of just some 10 simple ways that corporate America, hedge fund owners, the wealthy, are able to pay little or no taxes and how much they get in return. So they don't only not pay, they get money in return. And the amount is staggering. Remember I said we should really be focused upon a single federal income tax that nobody can get out of, that no deductions are allowed, that you eliminate the IRS, that everybody has to pay, and it would bring an additional $1.2 trillion annually in. Well, then I also suggest we stop all the subsidies, stop 100% of the subsidies to corporate America. That will bring us in a lot more money, and I have specifics on exactly how much that will be based upon how much last year was taken. It's over $800 billion. So there's a lot we can do. We're going to talk about that in that segment. Let's begin. First up, there's a vitamin almost nobody pays attention to, unless you have gout or you have severe swelling, then it's good. Vitamin B5. The question is, can it promote longevity? B5 is also known as pantothenic acid. It was discovered back in 1933 by a person who I interviewed. In fact, I brought him to New York City, the Waldorf Hotel, along with Linus Pauling and Albert Sangiorgi, who discovered vitamin C, ascorbic acid, won the Nobel Prize, Dr. Ellis. All these great vitamin discoverers, I had in one place for one whole day. They were really brilliant. And he talked about it at that time, about how its name means from everywhere, since it can be found in a wide variety of foods, and why it's so important, and we weren't getting enough. Well, the reality is the health benefits of vitamin B12 are widespread due to the fact that it's a precursor to coenzyme A, a cofactor needed for producing hormones, neurotransmitters, and fats. And vitamin B5 helps your body extract energy from the food you eat. It also is a precursor to red blood cell production. That makes it essential to your red blood cells. Interesting, it may also be the reason why queen bees live about 5 times longer than worker bees. And researchers that were working with Dr. Williams revealed that mice treated with pantothenic acid live longer than unsupplemented animals. On average, they live 19% longer than untreated. So, another study found that rats that were given vitamin B5, pantothenic acid, increased their ability to withstand stress. And in the realm of bees, queens are made, not born. Most people are not aware of that. Future queens develop into larvae that are different from the worker bees. This is due to royal jelly. Royal jelly, which the queen larvae feed on exclusively, nothing else, results in the development of a sexually mature queen bee. Now, the queen bee, who is the mother of most bees in a hive, is significantly different than the sterile worker bees that surround her. Her abdomen is significantly longer than other bees, making her stand out. Her fertility is awe-inspiring. A mated queen can lay up to a couple of thousand eggs per day, especially in the springtime. And the most striking difference between the queen bee and her surrounding workers is her lifespan, which ranges from 1 to 5 years. In comparison to a worker's bee's life is about 1 month. While Rhoyl actin is the component of rhoyl jelly, recently identified as the essential element for the queen-making property. 20% of rhoyl jelly by weight is pantothenic acid, making it one of the richest sources of vitamin B5. And the recommended intake of vitamin B5 for 14 years or and older is just 5 milligrams daily. However, the only adverse effect seen with higher doses is some diarrhea. Go too high, 20 milligrams. It's too much. And while B5 deficiencies are rare, symptoms can include fatigue, insomnia, headaches, and intestinal disorders. And because it's water-soluble, pantothenic acid is best taken in divided doses several times a day. It's always taken with food. And first and foremost, you can simply eat foods that are rich in pantothenic acid. Whole grains, legumes, good, and broccoli, potatoes. If you're a meat eater, poultry and meat. And of course, B5 can also be found in B-complex supplements, many multivitamin formulas. And since it's a cofactor for acetylcholine production, you almost always find it along with choline in memory and brain-enhancing formulas too. So it's just a nutrient that we don't pay a lot of attention to that deserves a lot of respect, and we should be including it. And I can remember a woman who loved rhoyl jelly. She was 75 when she came to a lecture I was giving, and she talked about how in her native home of Romania, there was a doctor named Anna Oslin, and she was known as the anti-aging doctor. And it was through her, by the way, that I got in contact and met with and had long conversations with Anna Oslin. And she was giving injections of some anti-aging serum. But she said more than anything, she gets people to eat rhoyl jelly each and every day, and that she's inspired by how long the beekeepers live and what she's been able to do with rhoyl jelly. And here was this woman who was extremely healthy, and she was eating rhoyl jelly every day. Her skin was very young, and then she told me about other people who I also interviewed who were using rhoyl jelly also, and one of them was John A. Lee McFadden. This woman never had a negative day in her life. She was always positive, always upbeat, always with a smile. And she was, I think, 90 or 95 years of age and just full of energy. And I remember when I did one of my first social parties and dance parties, she said, "Am I too old to come there?" I said, "Of course not." I said, "There's no age to which someone shouldn't enjoy socializing and music and dancing." And she said, "Oh, I'd love to come." I said, "Well, come." And she did, and she brought some other friends. I think the youngest of those friends was 85, and they had a big time. In fact, on one of the recent videos that are now put up on Gary Nall YouTube, I think it's called, there were five or six. One was called, Bentley's. You'll see that I'm dancing with a group of very older women, and that was that crowd. And so they all were into rhoyl jelly. They all swam. Swimming was their big thing. And they were vitalists. They believed in vitalism. And when you're up close to them and you're looking at them, their eyes are clear. Their tongues are clear. Their skin is resilient. They just look so much different for their age than the average person, the same age. And I just wanted to share that because, and by the way, many of you, we're guesstimating from these home movies that people took of some 50 different dance parties of over 50,000 members this radio audience came to, you'll probably be able to find yourself in there. These were films that were given. Some we couldn't put up because you simply couldn't see anything. There was no lighting. And sometimes the cameras would zoom in and out, and those would just make you sick. So, but the ones that were actually watchable, we put up there. So why don't you go and watch, see if you can see yourself, Anna Goldwasser and Reed Eater and all these other people that I don't know what's happened to them, where they're at. You see them and you'll see yourself, and you'll see yourself in the 1970s and 80s and 90s styles and hairdos, and it's really fun. So go up and take a look. In any case, that's when I think about the stories of how many people were using royal jelly. So what I do, there I am at the Institute, and I decided to do a feeding experiment with rats that normally live about a year. And I started to give them royal jelly every day. And I also, that was the only thing that was different. I wanted to try one experiment at a time. So you give them their standard chow. Everyone has to get the same amount of water, same amount of light, everything. But the difference is royal jelly. And the group that got the royal jelly lived about 16% longer. But I also noticed that they were not suffering from obesity or aggressiveness, which this frequently happens. So I just think royal jelly is one of the most perfect things in nature. And now we know that pantothenic acid might be one of the reasons for it. From those of you who care about herbs, and kava is certainly one of the better ones out there, kava aqueous, which means a water extract from the roots of the Piper methylsticum, is traditionally served as a beverage for South Pacific Islanders. Any of you have been to the South Pacific, if you've been there, you know this because it's so common. Well, they find evidence that links kava to a very low incidence of certain cancers in South Pacific countries. And now they're looking at this more carefully and asking what's in there. Well, they're finding what are called cavalactones, organic extracts of also have a long history of traditional use for anxiety. Most people think, I'll take kava if I'm anxious, if I'm stressed. However, kava also has made headlines for the wrong reasons, with reports of potential liver toxicity that was based upon very high doses, and that was about 10 years ago, but a lot of that was discredited. Now we see that it has an impact as an anti-cancer agent. So more research on that. I just look at the studies and I say, that's interesting. And this was done at the University of Minnesota, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Prevention Research. And it helped prevent a lot of the damage, the DNA damage from tobacco carcinogens from manifesting. Quote, this research is truly unprecedented in its potential impact. A 99% cancer prevention efficacy is unheard of with this very sensitive research model and paves the way for future clinical trials to assess human applications. We should look at kava as an example that we shouldn't rely on natural killer cell kill a very promising product, end quote. So it depends upon the preparation, depends upon the extract and the quality of it, but it looks like kava should be one of the things we're now considering for cancer. More on that as it is evolved. And finally, complementary medicine in wide use to treat children with autism developmental disorder. I'll quote from the University of California. In a study of the range of treatments being employed for young children with autism and other developmental delays, University of California, Davis Mind Institute researchers have found that families often use complementary and alternative medicine treatments, and that the most frequent users of both conventional and complementary approaches are those with higher levels of parental education and income. So, by the way, there is no FDA-approved medical treatment for the core symptoms of autism spectrum disorder, which becomes a lifelong neurodevelopmental condition whose hallmarks we're all familiar with, deficits in social relatedness, repetitive thoughts and behaviors, and intellectual disability. So according to the Journal of Behavioral Developmental Pediatrics, people are becoming highly educated, and then they're trying these therapies. Now, they don't judge it right or wrong. They just think it's unusual. Well, here's what's unusual. What's unusual is when I go to Chicago and I meet at a hotel with 400 parents and their children, many of those parents are medical doctors. One was a professor of medicine. All their children had developed autism spectrum disorder, Asperger's, all according to the parents after the child that was developing normally had a multiple vaccine input into the body and then developed autism. All of them were in various stages of improvement. Several were virtually normal, and they had used natural and complementary techniques, different ones. I was allowed to film them because they knew of my research, and they also knew of the young man, Jonathan Feldman, Jonathan Ortega, who I had helped with the protocol that his parents diligently used, and they're extremely disciplined, to New York City police officers. And they had found that only by using this protocol, first it overcame his seizures, then it allowed him to speak that he hadn't done. He was grunting for years. Then it regressed his violent and outburst, and then it helped him focus. And then he was able to get into a normal school way behind all the other students, and then he was able to accelerate until he was student of the week. And I invited him and his parents to make this presentation before a group of scientists, thousands of scientists, which they did, during my talk in Washington, D.C. at a World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicine. And they were all just blown away by this because they had never seen this. But had they been in Chicago, they would have seen it, because I got them all in this one room and standing like six deep in the night, slowly panned the camera. And all the young people were in these beautiful little blazers. They just looked so neat. And then you talk with them, and they could articulate. But it was the last guy that really got me. Now, I'm setting up the shot, and then I'm standing behind the camera guy. And our frontline producer was there and just explaining, we need each person just to give us a word about what you feel today versus, you know, years ago. And we did the whole thing, and this guy at the very end, I'm guessing he was 16 or 17. And he said, I just want to say thank you to my parents who never gave up on me. Wow. I pulled the camera back. Wasn't a dry eye in the place. Think of that. A kid who understands that because of the dedication and determination to seek out the truth, he was able to have a life. And then you think of all the other kids, the million kids who won't have that life. They'll have diarrhea 10 hours a day. They'll have screaming episodes so bad that people think you're abusing your child. They'll get so large that you can't put them in a home. You have to put them in an institute where they are zombified. They're kept on drugs and immobile. And yet here's a whole group. Now, what would happen if instead of this being in my film, which you can see in Autism Made in the USA, but what if this had been on 60 Minutes or the New York Times, which will never, never attend any of the press conferences we do because they're afraid of the truth, and we invited them repeatedly, and they stayed away from our AIDS press conference, where they could have seen people completely reversing their AIDS-defining illnesses. Over 100. Took a year and a half to put that together. Medical records, doctors, all benefiting, all improving, and some completely reversing AIDS, and a whole medical team there, and no one shows up. And yet people say, oh, you know, you're against what? What? I'm against stupidity? Yeah. Top of my list. Truth denialism? Yeah. These are truth deniers. And so we know the truth about autism. We know the truth about AIDS. We know the truth about cancer and arthritis and depression. There are alternative models that can help and have. But if we don't focus them, if we don't give them a forum, if we don't offer them legitimate challenge, the world will never know. That brings me to this idea that we pay attention only to the treatment and what it costs, not to whether it works. If we actually demanded quality, gold standard, double-blind, placebo-controlled, independent design studies and statistically substantial markers of improvement over a placebo, a sugar pill, 90% of all the medicines you're using you wouldn't, 90% of the medical procedures given wouldn't be given, 90% of all medicine would be quackery. But instead of holding medicine to any standards whatsoever of independent accountability, we just pay. And our arguments today are the wrong arguments. Who should pay? Should Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, workman's compensation? Should Obamacare, private industry? Who should pay? That's where the argument is. That's the wrong argument to have. The argument should be, does the procedure work? That's where the argument is. Can we prevent the condition in the first place, and can we treat it and save the patient, improve the quality of life in the second? Do you ever hear this argument? Never. And that's the problem. It's all about who pays. This year, more money will be spent on medicine and on health care than anything else in our society. So much will be spent that it's twice the entire budget of the military-industrial spy complex, twice that, $3.2 trillion. Here's what Ralph Nader has to say from Huffington Post, quote, and I'll post this on our website today. An epidemic of skyrocketing medical cost has afflicted our country and grown to obscene proportions. Medical bills are bloated with waste, redundancy, profiteering, fraud, and outrageous overbilling. Much is wrong with the process of pricing and providing health care. The latest in this medical cost saga comes from new data released this week from the National Nurses United, the nation's largest nurses organization. In a news release, the National Nurses United revealed that 14 hospitals in the United States are charging more than 1,000% their cost for treatment. So if something costs, let's say, $100 to the hospital, they're charging you $1,200. Wow. You don't find that in book publishing. You don't find that in recording. You don't find that in food. You don't find that in clothing. But you find it in medicine. No one's questioning it. And the key findings note that the top 100 most expensive U.S. hospitals have, quote, a charge-to-cost ratio of 765% and higher. And they found that despite the enactment of Obamacare, the Affordable Act, overall hospital charges experienced their largest increase in 16 years. And the for-profit hospitals continue to be the worst offenders, and with a minimum of 503% of their cost and profits above that. So, here are some. The 10 most expensive hospitals in the United States, listed in accordance to the huge percentage of their charges relative to their puny little costs. So they have very little cost, very little overhead, and huge profits. So just understand something, and I'm saying this, not Ralph Nader. These hospitals will tell you whatever they choose to and whatever they think that you will believe. But it's all about what he said at the beginning. It's all about greed. Meadowlands Hospital Medical Center, Secaucus, 1,192%. Paul B. H. Regional Medical Center, Painesville, Kentucky, 1,186%. Orange Park Medical Center, Orange Park, Florida, 1,139%. North Okaloosa Medical Center, Crestview, Florida, 1,137%. Gaddiston Medical Center, Gaddiston, Alabama, 1,128%. Bayonne Medical Center, Bayonne, New Jersey, 1,084%. Brooksville Regional Hospital, Brooksville, Florida, 1,083%. Heart of Florida Regional Medical Center, Davenport, Florida, 1,058%. Chestnut Hill Hospital, Philadelphia, 1,058%. Oak Hill Hospital, Spring, Florida, 1,052%. Now that, let me put it this way, so you could really get a handle on this. If this same philosophy occurred with an automobile, you'd be paying an average of about $60,000 for an average car. Not a high-end car, just an average car, if price gouging was the same everywhere. And how much will they make? Well, it's a bunch, about $3.2 trillion this year, and yet no one's saying a thing about it. From our environmental segment today, let's go back to a five-hour special I did on the tipping points. By the way, I have an upcoming for Martin Luther King Day. I have We Know Who Killed Martin Luther King, three-hour special. We Know Who Killed Robert F. Kennedy, five-hour special. We Know Who Killed Mahatma Gandhi, two-hour special. So those we've been working on, and you'll see some in-depth scholarship on that and the truth told. I was doing a special about the 12 tipping points, and I said that my biggest concern is that when we reach an area called chaos theory, where there is no accurate mathematical model, because once something starts to tip, the speed at which it can tip and the severity of it tipping, and then the subsequent waves of energy that produces, which can create further tipping, cannot be predicted. So on the one hand, you have the deniers who say, global warming, what's global warming? And yes, Richard Martin and other people say global warming doesn't exist, it's all fraud, and that's their right to say it. I don't believe in censoring. I don't believe in keeping people from having their points of view. They just don't have the truth or science on their side, but they have their opinions, and they have a right to their opinions. We, on the other hand, have a right to the science, and we also have a right to do our homework. For example, from Eric Zeus, quote, the billion-dollar-year program to deceive the public about global warming is exposed. Quote, a December academic article has documented how billionaires have made suckers of millions of people to cause them to believe that global warming is a mere hoax and to think that oil companies' line on that matter is honest. This research by Robert Burrell was published in the leading climatological journal, Climate Change, and it reports that a small number of aristocrats have collectively spent, on average, $1 billion a year in order to fool the American public into thinking that climate change isn't happening, and that, even if it is, it's not caused by burning fossil fuels. These aristocrats, these elitists, control fossil fuel corporations such as Koch Industries, ExxonMobil, but their money for this mass deception campaign is laundered through far-right-wing foundations they control, to think tanks they control, which in turn buy professors to provide authority for these distortions and outright lies. This is why the reality, though acknowledged by virtually all climatologists, is rejected, disbelieved by much of the public. Now, listed in order, with the largest listed first, the nine foundations that account for half of this $1 billion a year expenditure are Donors Trust, Schaefer, Bradley, Koch, Howard, Pope, Serial, Duns and Richardson. These are the foundations. Then their money is then further laundered through the following 11 think tanks, listed also largest first, which collectively account for a full two-thirds of this total $1 billion a year propaganda campaign. Now, just listen to the names I'm giving you, because you'll see these people on different talking shows, on Fox, on MSNBC, on CNN, on NPR. So remember, when they come on as an expert, you're thinking, well, okay, they're highly educated, they're an expert in the area, so I should trust their information. No, you should not. You don't know how much their foundation or their think tank has been paid, and they have several firewalls to prevent you from finding that out. Listen to the names. American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, Hoover Institute, Manhattan Institute, Cato Institute, Hudson Institute, Atlas Economic Research, Americans for Prosperity, John Locke Foundation, Heartland Institute, and Reason Foundation. They, in turn, pay professors and journalists to write, both for the news media and for professional journals, to debunk in the scholarly publications, to raise questions about global warming or its cause, and questions that are no longer even questions among actual climate scientists. And this study entitled Institutionalizing Delay, Foundations Funding and the Creation of U.S. Climate Change Counter-Movement Organizations, reports that all this money is spent, quote, on maintaining a field frame that justifies unlimited use of fossil fuels by attempting to delegitimize the science that supports the necessity of mandatory limits on carbon emissions. To accomplish this goal in the face of massive scientific evidence of anthropogenic climate change, which meant the development of an active campaign to manipulate and mislead the public over the nature of climate science and the threat posed by climate change, end quote. So, in lay language, the people with the enormous industries that do the polluting, they then set up a multi-billion dollar foundations that then funnel money to front organizations, that then funnel money to institutes, that funnel money to experts, that funnel money to professors and people who then write articles. All of this is $1 billion a year per group. That's a lot of money. And with that, you can constantly cause questions. Well, I heard someone say, you know, this is a professor, you know, and then he says, you know, global warming, look, it's cold and freezing, and it confuses people. So I just want you to know that the reason a lot of people are confused, the reason we have not spent more time as a nation looking honestly at global warming, is because there's a massive propaganda campaign underway. So when I'm telling you that there are 12 tipping points and four of them have tipped and are never going to untip, and that we're now in chaos theory, that means that you can have events occur that are almost instantaneous. And someone will say, well, why didn't we have knowledge this was coming? Because there's no mathematical model that can accurately predict it. And all the old models are simply very conservative estimates. So kick the can down. Don't worry about it today. It'll happen when you're dead 100 years from now. Not true. This is the latest to show you. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Nature Climate Change. Here's what they say, and you haven't heard this anywhere else. Quote, Antarctic glacier's irreversible melting threatens considerable increase in sea level rise. New study on Pine Island Glacier shows striking vision of the near future. An Antarctic glacier is melting irreversibly, offering, quote, a striking vision of the near future. And the study just came out today. It's the largest Pine Island, by the way, glacier, is the largest single contributor to sea level rise in the Antarctic. And the team of scientists used three ice flow models to look at the glacier's grounding line, which separates the grounded ice sheet from the floating ice shelf. And the grounding line, which has already retreated about 10 kilometers in the last decade, quote, is probably engaged in an unstable 40-kilometer retreat. It has started a phase of self-sustained retreat, meaning going into the ocean, which is bad, and will irreversibly continue its decline. That's according to the glaciologist Gail Durand. And a striking vision of the near future. Remember what he just said, quote, a striking vision of the near future. All the models suggest that the glacier's recession will not stop, cannot be reversed, and that more ice will be transferred into the ocean, end quote. Now, let me just put this in perspective for the average person. On average, it sheds 20 billion tons of ice annually. What are they predicting now? Oh, it's going up 100 billion tons annually off Antarctica. So that means that the slow and gradual rise of the ocean, it's not going to be slow and it's not going to be gradual. It's going to be quick, as you will see. Wish I was wrong, but that's what the science is showing. And also, from our environmental segment. From Common Dreams, coming to a field near you, Agent Orange Corn. 2,4-D, corn and soybeans just keep us on the same old pesticide treadmill. Despite widespread opposition from food safety, environmental watchdog groups, this audience, for example, and as health professionals, we're all concerned about the use of genetically engineered crops. Well, there's a new one, dubbed Agent Orange Corn and Soybeans. In its draft, the Environmental Impact Statement, released just yesterday, the agency said that it, quote, preferred option for Dow AgroSciences to enlist corn and soybean genetically engineered to be resistant to the herbicide 2,4-D is to deregulate them. 2,4-D, by the way, is the third most widely used herbicide in the U.S. It's made by Dow Chemical and was a component of Agent Orange, the herbicide that has been linked to Parkinson's, birth defects, reproductive problems, and endocrine disruption. I say that this should not be green-lighted. I say it should be banned. And the reason they want these Agent Orange crops is so that they will survive the chemical assault of 2,4-D, the pesticide. That's only going to increase the toxic pesticides in industrial agriculture while providing absolutely no benefit to consumers, none. And then it ends up creating super weeds in the process. Now, to make it even simpler, before we go to my guest, I want you to hear from, I'm going to guess she's 5 years old, maybe six. I'm sorry I can't show you the video. Because I can't do it live and have you video stream it, but it'll be up on my website. So you can, after the program, you can download it. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com, download it. It's just 2 minutes and 10 seconds long. Try it yourself. Try this, please. And then let me know the results. They went to the store and they bought a sweet potato. And they wanted to see how, you know, the roots would come out and it would sprout, which is what a healthy plant should do. And they put it in this jar with water and nothing happened. For weeks, nothing happened. Just looked like a sweet potato. So then they got another sweet potato that hadn't been sprayed. And sure enough, the roots came out. Then they got an organic sweet potato. And then you see this huge amount of roots coming out the way it should. And that's what you see. That's the visuals that you won't be able to see when you hear the young girl explaining this. So if my engineer has the a little audio clip ready, let's listen to what a little girl and her mom found out about what happens when you buy one of these Big Agra sweet potatoes or an organic sweet potato.
Hi, my name is Elise. I decided to do an experiment on how long it would take for a potato to grow vines. Me and my grandma went to the grocery store to get some potatoes, a sweet potato. All you do is put a sweet potato in a glass of water and wait for it to grow vines. We took a sweet potato and waited for 3 weeks. Nothing happened. We took another potato and waited for 3 more weeks. Nothing happened. So we talked to the produce man at the store, and he said, well, these will never grow vines. At the farms, they spray them with a chemical called bud nip. You should try one of our organic sweet potatoes. And over a month, it finally grew these wimpy little vines. Over that time, we went to Roots Market, Roots Organic Food Market, and got a sweet potato there. It only took 1 week for it to sprout. And look at it now! I decided to Google budnip. Budnip is a chemical that they put on vegetables. They also spray budnip on blueberries, carrots, onions, spinach, tomatoes, beets, and cranberries. Nick goes through the whole vegetable, so washing it won't make a difference. It's also called chloroprofen. Chloroprofen can kill animals that they've tested it on. It can even cause tumors. With all of the chemicals, no wonder so many people are getting diagnosed with cancer. Which potato would you rather eat?
Okay. Isn't it amazing? Yet all the scientists over at the FDA and USDA, they couldn't figure out that maybe something that doesn't allow the plant to evolve as it should would be unhealthy. And here she nails it. Well, you try for yourself and you'll see that. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go to our guest who's standing by now. He is Professor Marty Wolfson. He is director of the Higgins Labor Studies Program at the University of Notre Dame, where he's been a professor of economics since 1989. His research focuses on labor and financial markets and macroeconomic policies and globalization and local economic development. He also sits on the board of directors of the Community Forum for Economic Development in South Bend, Indiana, which promotes social and economic equality and improved living standards for local residents. And prior to Professor Wolfson being an economist at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C., he also received awards for advancing social and economic justice within communities and is a frequent contributor to Dollars and Cents website. He is also the co-editor of the Handbook of the Political Economy of Financial Crisis, published by Oxford University Press. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be with you.
We've been told that the U.S. gross national debt has reached $17 trillion, a 60% increase since Obama took office. And some analysts predict it will pass $20 trillion before his second term is completed. The debt is now larger than our gross national product. Business Insider broke down the debt, showing that the majority of that money is owed ourselves, which is through local governments and pensions, and mutual funds and savings, and bonds and banks and private pensions and insurance companies, and $2.6 trillion to Social Security. And the federal government and the Federal Reserve are owed $5 trillion and foreign nations an additional $5 trillion. Now, these figures have politicians worried, including Obama. But how worried should we really be when a huge amount of this debt is actually what the government owes to itself? And then why can't we simply be enlightened and forgive this debt so we can give the American public and our government a chance to, in effect, start over at least all the debt that is not owed to a pension or where it would impact someone directly, and especially the interest on the debt that is owed to banks where we bailed out those banks, and those banks would have been insolvent without us, and those banks frequently work against our own interests. Why can't we just do the right thing? Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think you're right. I think we should. And there's been an enormous amount of scare tactics over the size of the federal debt. And I heard your discussion earlier in the program where you were saying to be cautious about economists and others and think tanks who put out information or perhaps misinformation. One example of this was from the Heritage Foundation, which not too long ago trumpeted the fact that the national debt outstanding had passed $17 trillion. Their analysis of it was that, and I'm quoting here, entitlement spending, the key driver of spending and debt, remains unaddressed. And this analysis is really misses the boat. First of all, the $17 trillion is really the wrong figure to focus on. And in particular, the idea that this debt was caused by out-of-control entitlement spending and that therefore the best thing to do would be to cut back entitlement spending is not only wrong, it makes absolutely no sense at whatsoever. As you mentioned, 2.7 a trillion of that $17 trillion outstanding debt is intergovernmental debt owed to the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, the way this works is that when workers pay their payroll tax into Social Security, it goes into the Social Security Trust Fund, which invests that money in U.S. government securities. It's required by law to invest in U.S. government securities. So the more money that comes into the trust fund, the more that they invest in U.S. government securities. And those government securities are what's counted as part of that $17 trillion fund. Now, this came about because in 1983, President Reagan set up a task force to investigate Social Security, headed by Alan Greenspan. And he recommended that we raise the payroll tax that workers pay for Social Security and Medicare to its current 12.4%, 6.2% for Social Security and paid by the worker, and 6.2% paid by the employee, the employer. So that dramatically increased the amount of money that went into the trust fund, and that's what's built up this $2.7 trillion of government debt. So the idea that we should cut government Social Security benefits to try to reduce this outstanding debt is absurd, because the more that we cut benefits, the more money that accumulates in the Social Security Trust Fund, the more money that is then invested in government securities, the more that the outstanding debt increases. And so had we cut benefits over time, when the alarmists first began saying that we were in trouble, the federal debt would now not be $17 trillion, but it would be, in fact, $18.2 trillion, because of all the money going into the trust fund and being invested in government securities. So really, I think we need to understand this as a smokescreen, as a false scare tactic to get people concerned about the debt and to label entitlement spending as the problem, when really it's not the problem at all. And cutting Social Security benefits would only expand the national debt. So we should realize this is really an attack on the social safety net, and that's really what's behind it.
I have four interrelated issues, if you would address them, please. One is, we were given the dismal new job report issued last week showing there were only about 70,700 new jobs, and yet those were holiday jobs in December. Over 95% of those were in the retail trade and not permanent. And what really bothered me is that no one in the government seems to just be honest and say, here's how many actual unemployed or underemployed Americans we have. So they do this alchemy that if you no longer seek a job, you're no longer considered unemployed. And that's now over 5.5 million Americans are out of that job picture. So if you look at the actual unemployment or the actual underemployment, where college graduates, master's degrees, even adjunct professors are frequently earning $10, $12 an hour, way below what they should be based upon their educational skills, based upon the deficiency of those jobs in the marketplace. And yet you'll hear people on Fox say, oh, just work harder. We did. You could. You know, don't be lazy. And I see people who are poor, who are working two jobs, and they're not lazy, and yet we're not being honest about the actual number of unemployed. Secondly, I'm tired of hearing Glenn Beck and other people talk about, oh, these entitlements like Social Security. Excuse me, since when did Social Security become an entitlement? I paid in it my whole life. I also am self-employed, so I pay twice. As an employer, you pay. As an individual, where do these people think that that is an entitlement? And lastly, I looked at real entitlements, actual statistics, and they add up this year to $844 billion through state and local subsidies to corporations. According to a story in the New York Times by Louise Story, it amounted to $80 billion subsidies to corporations. That was only 48 corporations. Then we have the direct federal subsidies to corporations. The Cato Institute estimates that to be $100 billion. Then we have the federal tax breaks for corporations, and they're supposed to pay 35%, but they actually only pay 13%, and that costs us $200 billion. Then we add in the national priorities projects, estimates the cost taxpayers $83 billion. Why? Because they're actually subsidizing the fast food industry to the tune of $243 billion a year for public benefits for their workers. That's according to University of Illinois and University of Berkeley, showed that $243 billion each year in indirect subsidies to the fast food industry because they're paying them too low wages. Then you got the mortgage deductions. You got the billions that are not counted in the government bailout, which was actually over $16 trillion. And each major piece of legislation contains new welfare for the rich and corporations. You add all that up, and I have. It's $844 billion last year. Why don't we ever talk about that as a problem, instead want to take what the small amount the poor and middle class have and take that away from them?
Well, that's an excellent point. And I think you're absolutely right to point that out. I think it's important to see our whole economic picture in the context of a 30-year campaign on the part of America's multinational corporations to really boost their profits by attacking labor and undermining labor by moving abroad, by outsourcing, by using part-time temporary contingent work, by assaulting unions, by right-to-work campaigns, by attacks on collective bargaining, and also by a government policy of the kind that you're talking about, which provides subsidies and tax breaks and all kind of help to the big corporations, but yet has mounted a sustained campaign to try to cut back the social safety net. It's not only trying to undermine Social Security and Medicare, but it's also, we're seeing it happen right now with this fight over extending unemployment insurance, by the cutbacks in food stamps, by the resistance to raising the minimum wage, which is lower now than it was in 1968 in real terms, by many governors who refused to accept money for Medicaid, leaving thousands and thousands of their citizens uninsured. And the it's all been supported by the kinds of things that you're talking about, a kind of ideological campaign to attack the victims, to say that unemployment insurance is something we should cut back upon because this would deter people from getting jobs. I mean, that argument is so ridiculous in the face of it, because you can't get unemployment insurance unless you're actively seeking work. And the whole point of the argument is to attack to blame the victims, to try to implement exactly the policies which are undermining our economic performance, the kinds of transfers of wealth and income to those at the very top, while attacking unions and workers and the ordinary citizens by undermining the social safety net. We need to be dramatically expanding our programs for job creation, by which I mean spending on infrastructure, on education, on worker training, we need to be shoring up the social safety net by unemployment insurance and food stamps and so on, not shredding it as we are. So it's the height of hypocrisy to say, that we need to cut back on unemployment insurance because these lazy workers don't want to work.
I would agree with that. We're out of time. Thank you so much for your good work, Professor Marty Wolfson. We appreciate you fighting for the average person, bringing your strong academic understanding and your practical experience as having been an economist for the World Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C., and all of your articles to this forum. We appreciate it. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day. We're out of time, so let's just say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today it's Tuesday, Open Forum Day, and it's listeners having their say on the program.
Great. Right now, Utrice Lead.